Hello and welcome to VHTB, your guide to the talent, culture, and finance side of the space startup ecosystem. My name is Matt Jurtzen from Better Everyday Studios. I am joined today by Brian Majeure of Ad Astra Talent Advisors. How are you doing, Brian?
Fantastic. Excited to be here.
Awesome. And we are also joined by Justice Killian of Space Capital. How's it going?
Hey, Justice? Excited to talk. What a crazy start to the year.
Yeah. Been an absolute crazy start to the year. I'm really excited about this particular discussion. With the craziness of the year, with the craziness of the space startup ecosystem over the past few years, I've gotten the privilege of working with lots of companies, and when I tend to work with them, it's usually in a little bit later stages. But I've still, over the past couple of years, worked with a couple companies that subsequently went under. And I'm sure, you know, that's just a natural thing that happens in any kind of startup ecosystem. Something doesn't work, whether it's the money side, the tech side, the people side, whatever it is. That's kind of why we're here, is to, you know, find out what works, what doesn't. And especially for you all, which I think both of you, you know, you get involved in companies much earlier than I tend to. I would be really interested to hear your thoughts on kind of what are some of the early missteps that you see in companies, whether or not that leads to, you know, ultimately the company not working or not, but just like, what are you tending to see that are the common early mistakes?
I could go ahead and respond first here, since this is, you know, what I do on a day-to-day basis. You could ask, you know, 10 investors, what are the common pitfalls or mistakes, and you'll get 10 different answers. But I am going to focus on what I see as the most common, you know, patterns across our portfolio of about 50 companies. And then I did have a nice long stint at another fund, with 50 to 100 companies before that. So sort of synthesizing those observations across over a decade, I would say there's sort of three buckets. And one of them is actually more common today than was when I first got my start. So right out of the gate, I think failing at early hires is probably the single biggest mistake that I think companies make. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll fail, but the consequences, you know, a year, 2 years, you know, when you scale to 20 or 100 employees or 1,000 employees can be, you know, catastrophic. And the biggest one, I think, is actually at a cultural level. If you hire the wrong people, you create sort of an insular culture, it can be really hard to add people into that environment when you try to grow. So, you know, I think that starts from like only hiring from within your network on those first couple hires. You know, what you're essentially doing is copying yourself or copying your skills or copying your experiences. And you know, I would argue in that case, on average, you're just sort of maintaining the sort of talent bar in the best case and potentially lowering that with every sort of copy that you make. And I think that leads to like groupthink. It makes, you know, it leads to sort of a lot of like in crowd versus out crowd, anybody who's outside of that group.
Yeah.
And so that's where those cultural implications show up. Ways I've seen that have been, you know, really important to sort of manage around that. I actually think SpaceX, particularly in the early years, did a great job of this. So, you know, Elon, the rumors are that Elon, you know, was present for every hire for the first 1,000 employees. Didn't matter what sort of role or seniority, he participated in the interview process. And so when we talk to founders, we recommend that the CEO should be directly involved in at least the first 100 hires. You'd be surprised that, like, I think, you know, CEOs are willing to outsource that, you know, very early and not participate even in final round interviews. And I think that's a big mistake. The other thing that I think early stage or SpaceX got right in the early days was intentionally hiring from industries outside of aerospace, right? They were seeking to disrupt the status quo, and it intentionally required skill sets from different industries and diverse backgrounds. And so they were looking for people that didn't only have the academic pedigree, but had demonstrations of excellence in other areas outside of just schoolwork or just sort of their immediate work. So that's the first observation. I'll just pause there and sort of see what everybody's thoughts are, because there's two more that are worth hitting on.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to go to you, Brian. I mean, that's right up your alley. So yeah, what do you see with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that hits the nail on the head with a lot of the same things that I'm observing. I think one interesting thing that it is really hard for founders to navigate in that early stage, though, is if you are trying to hire outside of your network early on, like, it is great for diversity of thinking and groupthink and having helping with the in-group, out-group cultures. And I really like that. And also, you really need like a very small team tends to operate much more effectively if they've worked together in the past. And so it's this really complicated thing, like, of you want to have some of that early synergy to like get started and like have build momentum quickly. But I think exactly to Justice's point, I think a lot of times companies rely on that for too long. They're like, oh, we got this going well and we got this good momentum. And then they just keep following that until next thing you know, they're 30, 50 people, pretty much all hired from their network, not from other industries. And they're just doing things the way they've like always done it. And they make it a lot harder to hire from other places and go in different directions and kind of take a more, like have their skills be elevated from where it was before, like have that bar be raised, like Justice was mentioning. So I think one key place that you can improve upon that we don't see happening too often on the hiring side of things is in this, so far as conversation sounding like really valuable and built on like our previous conversations about culture and hiring from other industries. But I think we really got to be focusing on, you know, what is our culture and like, how do we hire for culture first? How do we hire for personalities that are hungry and driven and fit with the ethos of the company and who can do a lot and be a multi-tool and just go in and kill it? And I think a lot of times an early misstep is like, well, today I need a structural analyst. I'm going to like find this really specific skill set and like, it's not the perfect fit, but it's a buddy. I know they do good work type thing. Right. Whereas no, let's tap other areas, find the right type of people and then get them in. And if they're hungry and well aligned, they're going to execute.
You're really making me feel good about one of the things that I focus on with teams is building trust.
Yeah.
And kind of to your point, Brian, of, you know, there's this push and pull of you need voices from a lot of different places. You want a variety of backgrounds, but you also want people to know each other well, so they know how to work together. And I use there's a team formation cycle that's called like the forming, storming, norming, performing cycle of team development. And like a lot of the things that I try to bring to companies is, how do you like speed run that cycle so you can get to know each other a lot faster rather than just kind of working together for years? So feels good. That sounds like that would be valuable for some of these people.
Yeah, and I'm here curious to hear more Justice's other thoughts. That first one was really, really great to get it started.
Before we go there, Brian, I'm curious, you know, so we recommend that CEOs be involved in the hiring process. As a recruiter, do you get that very often? And, you know, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think in general we do, and it when it happens, which is most of the time, it is really effective. And like you said, I think that first 100 is important, and they naturally, CEOs start to become less and less involved in the hiring process as they scale, and that makes sense, and that's great. But I agree they need to be involved in at least speaking to and having a say in the hiring process through at least 100. I think you're absolutely right. And yeah, SpaceX absolutely did that to 1,000, and then even beyond, like, I think he was at least approving resumes even well beyond 1,000. So just not necessarily having one-on-one interviews past 1,000. And so I think it's important to stay in the trenches more than you think, and giving your hiring team access to both hiring managers and the CEO so that the whole team is cohesive and aligned on storytelling, on what we're looking for, and we have access and open communication to all the key stakeholders is really important. And if we don't have the CEO involved, it tends to not be as effective.
It's actually something that I just recently had on my other podcast, had an interview with Jesse Kleekamp, who's the head of recruiting at K2 Space. And she talks a little bit about the process of how rigorous they are coming together as a team, not even of the interview process itself, but of deciding to hire, you know, of like being, what is this role going to do? Who's the right person for it? Where are we going to look? And they get kind of across the board agreement, I think, from kind of the executive level of like, yes, this is a role that makes sense that we're going to do. So to your point about that storytelling of what we need, they get really early alignment on that in the hiring process.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, the CEO is the glue and the ultimate authority and needs to be owning both like culture and storytelling. And so there needs to be that clear vision and alignment. And hiring managers are going to have different types of subcultures within their teams and different preferences for what they want. And that's not all bad, but there has to be a top level cohesive thought process that ties it all together. And I think that's the CEO's responsibility for, yeah, 100 plus hires.
Great insight. All right, so going to the second one that we commonly see. So this is particularly true with really technical founders in sort of the space tech ecosystem. You get some brilliant engineers that have been living a set of like technical problems, and they say, we can build a better solution. It's a solution that they want. And you know, it's sort of this if you build it, they will come mentality. And that can be very, very, I mean, it can be very cool because you can move fast, you do things, and you know, you can convince people that you're going to build this really elegant, you know, complicated solution, you know, and but what you're doing in sort of absence of that is you're not listening to the customer, you're not developing a culture that is seeking customer insight and rapidly iterating what you're building to meet the need of the customer. And so you never build that muscle. And it can make it very, very hard for the company to scale and sort of expand revenue. And so you know, one example from our investment history is a company called Planet Lab. So you know, they're publicly listed. This didn't impact them from a you know, potential bankruptcy standpoint, but it did mean that they ended up having to raise a lot more capital. So the backstory here is that you had you know, brilliant satellite engineers building satellites, small form factor satellites that could take pictures of the Earth and do, and the goal was to be able to do that daily. The challenge was that those small form factor satellites, you know, had very low resolution imagery that nobody really wanted. And so they were able to image the, you know, entire Earth daily, but, you know, as they were sort of building, you know, that data collection foundation, then they realized, okay, well, we actually don't have enough of the ground segment. So they had to go build the ground segment. And then they realized they didn't necessarily have the processing capabilities or the analytics capabilities. So they had to raise more money to build all of that out. And then, you know, when they built their platform, it was a very general purpose platform where the users of that, you know, data are very, very specialized. And so they ended up sort of building this general purpose platform that like people didn't really want. So, you know, long story short, they ended up acquiring SkySats from Google, and that ended up driving a lot of value for the company. It was much higher resolution and much better data. And they've sort of zeroed in on a couple market segments, primarily DoD, which anchors their revenue, and a little bit of agriculture, which is a pretty big customer. And so, you know, what that meant from us as an investor and early employees is it means there was a lot of dilution. It took much longer to build their products. You know, the value of your shares got diluted over time. And so, you know, it was a lot of risk. It was a long period of time, and it wasn't really a great investment unless you were like super, super early there. So, you know, that's one lesson learned. Any thoughts on that around, you know, if you build it, they will come?
I mean, from the thing that's resonated with me or that I'm hearing with that is definitely that I have also seen is just like the importance of just like a true clarity of purpose that matches a need in the right way. You know, I think of I think I've mentioned before, I recently listened to an interview with the CEO of Astroforge, the CEO of Astroforge, you know, getting ready to go mine asteroids. And he says, as a CEO, the number one job he has is reminding people of what they're doing and stop. Don't do other things. Just do this thing. Get really focused on kind of doing the thing that gets to market in the quickest way possible. I think about that a lot with Vast, of why I'm really excited with Vast, because, you know, for their first Haven 1 launches, they're not even gonna, you know, they're relying on Dragon 2 to provide the environmental systems, you know, so it, you know, just kind of from that technical point of view of knowing like, what are the things that we need to solve? What are the things that they can solve? So that you don't wind up constantly, you know, opening up doors and be like, oh, there's this whole other thing over here. No, and you know, having to go get more money.
Yeah, I think, you know, a similar story, I was speaking with a successful founder who's, you know, been a part of an organization that raised well over $100 million and looking to kind of do his next thing, and talking about what are some of the pain points, lesson learns, and what are you going to be changing and doing next. And it sounded like there was a lot more clarity in how to define the product development roadmap, how to tie that into each round of venture funding, and like what the goals of each of those rounds are, right? What are we building in that round? And what is like the absolute minimum that is needed, but yet is both like minimal, cheap, fast, and also is a complete integrated system, so that you're not just like building these individual blocks and then never putting it together and not knowing how it's going to work and figuring out all the complexities that go with putting it together. So what's a complete system? And also, what are the couple key biggest technical risks that we need to buy down in this round? And so just getting a lot of clarity on that early on and mapping that out to each round. And then, yeah, making sure your team knows like exactly what they're working on. Like, and when you talk about the different rounds of venture capital, like you need to nail each round. Otherwise, the next round's not coming. So we got to communicate that super clearly and make sure that you're actually hitting those goals and deadlines. Otherwise, like you're dead before you get to where you want to be.
So that's a really interesting transition to the third point that I wanted to touch on, which is a more recent phenomenon. And it is, you know, companies pre-seed, seed, you know, Series A are able to raise much larger rounds than they have historically. And so that's great in a sense that space tech companies can, you know, potentially fly hardware right out of the gate, right? That's you know, it accelerates their pathway into the market. The challenge with that is when the first money that you raise is $10 million, you know, scarcity drives innovation. It focuses the team on the highest priorities, this idea of like, what is absolutely critical that we have to buy down, you know, just like you're saying, Brian, and it forces you to only hire essential people that can do multiple jobs and really stretch beyond what they should be doing. And you have more capital, you end up filling more seats, you end up taking on more technical milestones, and it pushes you to go, I think it just spreads you thin. It doesn't give you the clarity that you need at that earliest stage. And so, you know, an interesting example, I won't name the company, but they're in our portfolio. And so what they are doing is collecting data for geospatial data. And so what they did early on, pre-COVID, was relied on a network of folks to essentially a distributed gig network to go out and actually collect points of interest that could be then layered on top of maps for contextual data. And this data is super hard to get in the emerging world. You know, it's very fragmented, super hard. So it was a very people-centric approach. When COVID hit, they were already tight on cash. The health restrictions that were being implemented around the world forced them to rethink their entire tech stack, their entire business model. And the lack of capital that they had forced them to get incredibly creative. And what came out of that was an AI-based solution that allowed them to scale from one country to over 120 countries with a data efficacy rate around 90%. No company has ever been able to do that. They were able to do that because of such, you know, tightly constrained environments and a really challenging situation that forced them to sort of reinvent their back end. And so, we're trying to push, you know, when we work with founders to really distill down like the critical milestones that you're hitting and not padding that budget too much and keeping it pretty lean, because it does create a sense of urgency and scarcity and sort of puts pressure, you know, on a team to really execute early on.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're describing with that company was they got to a place of needing to sink or swim, and it forced them to sink, and it came up with results that wouldn't have come up with otherwise. Yeah. And that's, yeah. And the founder I was speaking to earlier spoke to like, yeah, they were able to raise like a lot of money, and that was great. And also they took on more than they needed to. And that was one of the biggest lessons learned, was like, we were doing too much and we weren't quite organized at the time. And we looked back and we're like, what did we do the last 2 to 3 months? Like, kind of nothing. We had it really forced them to like reevaluate what they were actually needing to achieve at this next milestone. And that was like a huge lesson learned for them. I thought that was a really great example.
And it's probably one of the biggest differences between first-time founders and serial entrepreneurs. First-time founders define success by like how much capital they raised and sort of how many people they're hiring. And that really is sort of the talking points, versus, you know, serial entrepreneurs are going to say, I'm really seeking out that product market fit. I know what it looks like. I've grasped it before, and I'm not going to take any additional money until I get there. And if I don't, I'm okay walking away, because I don't want to waste people's time and I don't want to waste people's money chasing something that isn't there, you know? So it's sort of a maturation and hard lessons learned.
Right. Like, can I build a minimum viable product that's as simple and scrappy as possible that I think serves a market based on the information I have, and then take that to the market, take that to the customers and say, What do you think? Give me the feedback, and then now you can modify it and adjust it to deliver on it. But if you're overconfident on your market and over designing something, there's a strong chance you're gonna go in too many directions.
It's really interesting. Just as I'm listening to all these topics, kind of the two words that come to mind for me are creativity and discipline. It's finding the right balance between creativity and discipline. When it comes to hiring and some of those early hires, you need to be really disciplined in that you're hiring the right people for the right fit for that you know you can work well with, yet you need to bring in outside voices to give you some more creativity. You know, when it comes to that, some of the early rounds of financing, you need to make sure that you're raising, you're disciplined enough to kind of constrain yourself from the resources that you get to push you to be more creative and find more elegant solutions or better solutions. It seems like kind of a lot of the things that we've touched on in terms of the mistakes that people make early in these companies, it's either a lack of creativity or a lack of discipline, or an imbalance between those two.
My partner Tom always says it this way. He says, vision without execution is hallucination. I love that.
That's great.
So good.
That's a fantastic quote to end this on. So thank you both for the conversation. I look forward to the next one, as always.
Thanks so much.